Perimeter and the second time in Canada. Thank you, Luis and Alex and Franz for the invitation. So I'm going to disappoint you in several ways. The first one, I just realized that the motto of Waterloo is stability. So the first way I'm going to disappoint you is I'm going to be talking about bombs and instabilities in this wonderful place. I'm not going to be talking about, except in passing, about asymptotically ADS spacetimes, and I'm not going to talk about nonlinear evolutions, although, well, I was supposed to have something on that, but it's taking much, much longer than we all wanted. So I am going to explore, to entertain the possibility of having massive bosons around rotating black holes. Parts of this were already discussed by Oscar in asymptotically ADS spacetimes. I want to explore this in a bit more detail. This was work done in collaboration with several people. The muscle work was done by Paolo Pani, a Marie Curie fellow in Lisbon, Helvi Witek, finishing the PhD in Lisbon, and Richard Brito, starting his master in Lisbon. And these are some of the references if you want to know. So I'm going to talk about super radiance in rotating black holes. So it's good to know that we do have black holes in our universe. This is an animation of the trajectories of stars around the center of our own galaxy where we have a 4 million solar mass black hole. I always like to see this because people are doing incredible things with the black hole at the center of our galaxy. This is one example. So they basically started to monitor a fully ionized cloud of gas. It's going to pass. They produce a very nice animation. So it's going to pass very close to, well, very means 1,000 or so Schwarzschild radii, very close to the event horizon of the black hole. And this is a nice animation. In 2013, it's going to be the point of closest approach, and they are going to be able to be monitoring this in real time during the next few years. Okay? So it's real. I think very interesting things are being done right now, and it's also a nice opportunity for people doing theoretical work and black hole physics in general to explore new ideas. And this is one of the things I like to propose here.
Do you know how they, is that an actual solution to Einstein equations, or is that a drawing?
This. I think it's a drawing.
It's a drawing.
But
yeah.
People are doing this.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. They are doing this. They are even studying the tidal disruption of this cloud. But this is a. So black holes do exist. Super radiance requires rotation. And we know that black holes in general also have rotation, and actually most of the black holes we see, or we think we see, spin very fast. This is a table from last year listing 8 supermassive black holes, so the mass is here. Don't ask me what all these entries are. I only know a couple of them, mass and spin. So this is the mass of black hole, of the black hole. And this is the spin. You can see the spin is typically large and typically known to a good precision. Keep this guy here in mind. This is a 10 to the 8 solar mass black hole. And I want to convince you that by using this table, and particularly this guy, we are able to constrain the mass of the mass of a Broca field to within 2 or 3 orders of magnitude better than you can see in the data particle group.
For that particular region, you have other estimates,
what we need, I'm going to show that. The most important thing for us is that they're supermassive. I need the mass more than the spin, but you need them to be, spinning above some value.
Is there any astrophysical understanding for why the spins tend to be so large?
Well, yeah, I mean, if these guys, the answer is maybe yes and maybe no. If the black holes grow by accretion, there's no other choice. Okay?
This is a
selected subset of the data people have. There are lots of other, I mean, the spin in the black hole candidate seems
but
to be all over the place.
That, it was just saying
generically,
that it tends to
be large. Tends to be large just because accretion increases the spin of the black hole.
And also because if it is formed through gravitational collapse and you want to conserve angular momentum, it has to spin down really.
You can move things down.
Well, yeah.
There are lots of candidates with black holes.
Yeah.
Our central black hole, Avery brought it here, is studying it. I will tell you that the estimate is 0.3.
Yeah. Even 0.3 for us is very useful. I'm going to try and show you that.
Thank you.
Okay, so Oscar just told you that a rotating black hole displays superradiance. I think we hear sometimes that superradiance is the wave analog of the Penrose process. And what's, well, it's something similar at least. So basically, superradiance consists on throwing some wave and getting back something with the same frequency but a larger amplitude, okay? This is a single black hole. You could try, since I'm going to talk about bombs anyway, you could think about building, doing a chain reaction. So building up a cluster of black holes, of rotating black holes, and seeing if that leads to fission, to a chain reaction, okay? And it's more or less easy to show that you can't. This is an argument, as far as I know of, put forward first by Price and Tarkovsky, like many years ago. At most, the black hole has a negative absorption cross-section, which is of the order of the area of the black hole, okay? And to have this chain reaction, you need that the graviton that's flowing around the different black holes has to have a mean free path which is smaller than the size of the cluster. This is basically the calculation you do when you want to build a bomb, right?
I never
Well, if you were. So you know the mean free path, and you basically, the condition that it's smaller than the size of the black hole cluster gives you basically this condition. And for any, I'm doing this in generic space-time dimensions. And for any d larger than 3, it doesn't work because it says that the cluster has to be within its own Schwarzschild radii. Okay? So fission can't work, but another mechanism can. And this was actually already proposed in the first paper on this by Zoldovich, which basically consists on surrounding a rotating black hole by a wall, by a mirror. And the idea is very simple. You have superradiance. The wave is hitting on the black hole. It scatters off with a larger amplitude, gets reflected back at the wall, at the mirror, goes back in again, and so on and so forth. And this is an exponential process. Okay? This is what the original black hole bomb.
So in Zaldovich paper, what is this mirror exactly? How do you bounce off gravitational waves?
Oh, gravitational waves, you can't bounce off electromagnetic or...
Oh, so his paper was on the electromagnetic.
Yes.
Yeah, on a cylinder.
I think Bekenstein also has something like that. He actually does the calculation. This is very nice because you can actually do the black hole bomb. We've done it with Oshkan, Jose Lambert, and Chijun Yoshida for scalar waves, okay? To admit you have a wall, which reflects back scalar waves. And this basically gives you the growth time scale or the inverse of as a function of the mirror radius. Okay? And you see that there is a critical radius at which the instability basically goes away. And the reason, of course, is that superradiance requires this condition. Well,
there's more blackboard
right
here.
Right
over here. The chair
would
move.
Well, superradius is basically this condition, where this is just an angular momentum parameter. But the characteristic frequency is set by the size of the mirror. So if the mirror is too small, you basically get a frequency which is too large to fit in the system. Okay? So basically you stop. Sorry.
No problem. I need exercise.
You basically you stop the bomb process. Okay? Superradiance ceases to occur. And this is very nice because when Oscar and I were actually looking at this stuff, we realized more or less instantly that maybe this would also give you a bomb in ADS. Okay, of course, ADS is like a covariant box. Roberto just told us yesterday. So it should work in exactly the same way. Okay, and it turns out that you only need to be able to fit the modes of the black hole inside the box. And it turns out that large rotating black holes in ADS have a characteristic frequency which grows linearly with the black hole size. So those in principle cannot satisfy that condition. Okay, so you think, okay, large black holes are stable to this process, but small black holes, if you look at the frequencies, they are basically given by the pure ADS frequencies, and those can be made to fit in the box. And so small ADS black holes are unstable, and we show that analytically some years ago, and several people later on showed it numerically. I'm not going to be talking about this. I'm going to basically, for the rest of my talk, focus on this. There's a second way, or a third way, if you wish, to build a black hole bomb, and that is basically by giving mass to the field. Mass is interesting for several reasons, and mass does an interesting thing. If you study the effective potential for wave propagation of a massive field around a rotating black hole, you will see that the effective potential looks something like this. There's the usual centrifugal barrier, and then there's this very interesting potential well here where you can localize the nodes, okay? And because there is a tail which extends to the ergo region, usually the guy which is localized here grows exponentially with time. You can actually solve the wave equation in the small mass approximation. So the mass of the field, I'm calling it mu s. Okay. You can solve it analytically, and you get a result such as this one. This was by that Weiler many years ago.
You also need to assume that the rotation is small, right?
And actually, no. It works for any. You have to assume this guy mu m is small.
Only mu m.
Peter, what he's mentioning is that in order to have an analytical expression for the eigenvalues, since you have destroyed the harmonics and you know exactly,
you
know exactly the, you need to do the approximation.
I think you need to take a over m to be small.
That is not true because for mu m small, so
it implies the other.
Oh, I see. I see.
Okay.
But you are assuming that it is small.
No. So let me put this another way.
It implies the other?
The spheroidal harmonics has a function which is this. This is what you're referring to, that you cannot solve this analytically. But this process, you can show that, that mu squared minus omega squared is of order mu to the 4, and mu m is very small, so this guy, the solution of the spheroidal harmonics will be a spheroidal harmonic. So you know the eigenvalues. Okay? So the only approximation is small mu m. Anyway, this is also well known. And you can actually prepare a state where you have, let me show you a typical quasi-bound state which has this frequency, okay? Well, this is easy. You can do it by just direct integration of the scalar wave equation.
You're calling it a quasi-bound state because when you include a back reaction from gravity, this bound state disappears, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's radiated away.
No, I'm calling it quasi-bound because it's not a stationary state. Just because of that.
Is that because it tunnels through the barrier, or why is it?
Oh yeah. So this is basically exponentially growing in general.
But the effect that I mentioned, it's going to be there, right? I mean, any bound state of the scalar field is going to be radiated away in gravitational waves.
So you mean when you couple it non-linearly to gravity?
Well, gravity, if you couple it, if you take it into the, say, back reaction.
No. Here, no.
No, you're not taking into account back reaction, but when you include it, then it's going to be radiated away.
I'm going to show you what can happen, maybe, when you include
that
reaction.
Going to happen, I think.
Well, yeah, gravitational waves. But still you have the question for how, where does it saturate? It starts growing gravitational wave, you know, this is an L equal M equal one dominant mode, gravitational wave radiation is suppressed, so I don't think it's completely trivial. But yeah, I mean, the final state, you're basically going to radiate enough angular momentum that you spin down the black hole and that this stuff goes away, because if you spin it down, the superheating condition ceases to be valid.
But if you start at the onset of the instability,
then
there is a very fine-tuned solution
yeah.
that corresponds to some non-linear scalar hair that rotates around the black hole.
Yeah,
that's going to be a
very. But it's very fine. No, I think it's just very fine-tuned.
Well, no, no. But what Roberto says,
any perturbation will kick it off.
Yeah.
No. But I think that. Even
what Roberto says.
In a situation of space, there's no way that you can compile gravitational variation.
Yeah.
Oh no, sorry. Gravity will go through the barrier that the potential field doesn't fill.
This thing is going to emit the gravitational waves.
There's a way around that. I mean, eventually the black hole has to spin down. We just don't know exactly how it does so.
This is not in the box.
So there's no way to prevent the.
I mean, the box is basically, well, the quasi box is just a finite size ball.
But it's a box only for some modes.
Yeah. Well, in fact, I'll go back to that later. Yeah. But so you can build up these quasi-bound states or normal modes of this system. And there are several solutions. I'm going to show you. I'm showing you this for a reason. This is the fundamental mode, okay? So no zeros. Actually, this is in Kerschel coordinates, just because we evolved this stuff in this horizon penetrating coordinates. You also have an overtone mode. You have different kinds of modes, okay? And if you prepare a state, because you're lucky enough that you have these modes, and if you prepare a state in this pure mode, then you're going to see something very boring. So this is the time evolution of a state which initially consists on the fundamental mode. This is a curve like all spinning at 0.99, and we have tuned the parameters
4D.
Yeah,
4D. And the background is fixed, or is it?
The background is fixed. This is a linear. You don't like it, but.
No, I didn't say I don't like it. I was going to say, wow, you can do a point.
A plot.
No, 0.89 black hole, that would be very cool.
Yeah. And the mass, so we are basically tuning the mass of the field such that you have the maximum possible, the maximum possible instability, in the sense that, so the instability timescale is maximum for um around 0.4, when a is equal to 0.99 m, and the instability timescale is of order 10 to the 6. M. Okay, so you know that if you evolve this for 1,000 m, you're not expected to see anything interesting, unless you're able to evolve this for 1,000,000,000 m. And in fact, you just get something very boring, right?
So what are you plotting?
I'm just plotting the magnitude of the scalar field. This is a cut along the z-axis as a function of time. Colors, you know, magnitude of the field. If you prepare a generic state. Of course, you can have more interesting things. The evolution, this is a Gaussian center that R in Kerschel coordinates, 12 m. It has a width of, I think, 3 m, but I don't recall exactly. And the evolution looks more interesting. Okay. Well, it's not as boring, basically. Okay. Stuff is going on.
Very psychotic.
Right. And actually, if you look at the waveform, at the signal, at the scalar signal, at a fixed location, it has some interesting patterns. Just because we think, and we have substantial evidence for this, just because the waveform of a generic initial data consists on a superposition of some of the lowest line modes, okay? And what you're basically seeing is beating between different modes. You can actually compute the relative excitation of the modes, which requires just computing the residue of a quasi-normal mode at the quasi-normal frequency. Okay, it's a lot of work, but it gives you patterns such as this. And the reason I am just mentioning this in passing is because this is well known for, well, two decades or so. There have been at least a couple of time evolutions of this stuff. And the claim is that you can see, usually the claims are, oh, we find timescales for the instability which are two orders of magnitude shorter than the one you expect from a mode analysis. Okay? And what I think is going on is they are not looking at the instability timescale, they are looking at bidding. If, for instance, you start with a very highly spinning black hole and a small mass, okay, so this is small, the spacing between the frequencies is going to be very small, this is going to give you a bidding frequency which is very small, and this is going to give you a bidding timescale which is huge. So even though it looks like it's going linearly, this is just bidding. Okay? So it's not trivial to do these evolutions and get the correct instability timescale. This is the point of this slides. Okay. So this is linear. We are, well, eventually thinking about doing the nonlinear process. But I think, also in connection to yesterday's talks, that some work was done by Yoshino and Kodama this year. They basically evolved a mode which looks like that fundamental mode. They did not include self-gravity, but they do include the self-interaction term. Okay? And there's been conjectures that what could happen is that this scalar cloud could basically give rise to something that in condensed matter people call bosonova. And I think, well, I don't want to speak for them, I think they see signs of that. They see signs of collapse of the scalar cloud. And that's probably related to the self-interaction term that they turned on in the scalar field.
But these axions are not massive, right?
For them, they are.
It's called a sine Borland equation or something like that. So they mass.
The term, the axiom is shift symmetric, and the mass term breaks shift symmetric.
Well, I don't know what you call. So basically, they put a potential which is like cosine of phi.
Okay. Oh, so they don't put a just a 10
no, 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 no. I think this is inspired. What they are doing is inspired by this Patrick Quinn.
Right. So it's different from the mass terms that you had before.
Yeah.
Okay. If you start changing the
well, in fact, it has to be. You have to have some non-linearities in there.
Well, right.
If you start changing the sign of the interaction.
They didn't do that. Actually, that would be very interesting. But so anyway, I just wanted to ring. I just put this slide to tell you that something is being done along those directions, even if not in EDS. Maybe some of these things are being observed even in asymptotically flat geometries. Just because you have quasi-bound states, you have enough time to see this stuff happening, maybe.
Sorry, I was on. Well, they were starting with Kerr and then putting
the
scalar field in.
They always have Kerr.
With
self-interaction. Yeah.
But then why do you not see, as Roberto was saying, why? I mean, if you're stimulating a cloud that has axial dependence, then why does it not radiate?
Well, it does. They don't see that. They are not including any back reaction in the matter.
No. It radiates in the scalar. I mean, it's non-linear, so now it can radiate into.
Oh, but I guess it does radiate in the scalar.
I see, but you're saying it somehow still manages to leave. That's not what dissipates. I mean, something else happens. I mean, you don't just lose all of the scalar radiation.
Well, yeah, it depends on the time scale, right? Because if by that reasoning, these guys would be stable. I mean, if you apply that to this stuff, then a massive scalar around Kerr would be stable. So it depends on the super radiant time scale and on the time scale for energy dissipation to infinity. Right? It depends on how.
But maybe, I mean, here you have no self interaction, so this can't radiate. If you start with an unstable node, but you just stay in that node, there's no node mixing.
Right.
But when you have a nonlinear interaction, you can mix between the
growing
modes,
so it depends,
the radiation modes.
But so it depends on the competition between how much you're going to extract from the black hole and how much the nonlinearities are dragging into higher frequencies that are going to tunnel off. Right. So I don't think predicting the outcome is trivial.
But do you expect that this gravitational effect should become stronger the more the more you're getting to this Bossa Nova point, the effect of artisanal waves should be stronger, right?
I think that depends a lot on the initial amplitude of the field. Because, I mean, gravitational waves is only going to depend on the magnitude of the scalar, right? But on the other hand, the non-linearities in the scalar don't depend on that. Depend on the relative contribution. So
probably also depends on the strength of that self-coupling.
Yeah, yeah.
So
well, it's a trade-off.
Forms.
I mean, but the coupling to gravity, that's just the energy, right?
No, that's fixed. But I'm saying the relative. I mean, if you increase the self-coupling a lot, then I think you will form a singularity or something like
that.
Right. Yeah. So if you can,
which might be cloaked by an horizon.
Right.
On the strength of singularity, just because when you're in linear theory, there's no scale at all. I mean, the non-linearity is also controlled by the strength of the interaction, so I'm not sure there are. I'm not sure you can choose. I mean, if you have a mode that exponentially grows, but in linear theory, you can't really say whether it's big or small. It's just exponentially
when you've got
a non-linear interaction, you can say that.
Right. All I'm saying is that the size of that non-linear interaction. The number that you put in front of that nonlinear interaction, I think, will play a role. You will introduce a scale in the problem. I think.
Well, okay. So, as I was saying, this is more or less well known, and I'm going to basically try to generalize this to other fields or to other couplings. Actually, I'm going to do this just for one of them, the massive vector fields, and I'd like to mention that. We can do this for the scalar field, the massive scalar field, because it separates. So it's quite clean, it's quite easy. Of course, time evolutions, you can do it in general, but doing a mode analysis, which because of these time scales is much more useful, is very, very hard. Massless perturbations around Kerr separate, but that's almost a miracle. Okay. In general, they don't. Massive vectors such as Broca fields or other U1 fields, they don't seem to separate, but more about that soon. Gravito-electromagnetic perturbations of Kerr-Newman black holes also don't. And George and Oscar were telling you about rotating black holes in higher dimensions. I have that here somewhere. This separability may also be important to compute gray body factors of black holes, etc. So it would be nice to have some formalism that allows you to study on a mode basis perturbations of rotating black holes. Okay. I'm going to focus. The formulas I'm going to describe is generic enough. Well, we think. But I'm going to focus on massive vectors and show you some results. Massive vectors on Kerr. I'm going to show you some results for gravito electromagnetic perturbations of Kerr-Newman, maybe in the conclusions. Okay. So we tried. It doesn't seem like, if somebody has a nice suggestion, I'd like to hear it. It doesn't seem like the Proc equation, so you add the A squared term to the action. It doesn't seem like this stuff separates in Kerr, or at least we don't know how to do it. Sometimes we hear the argument that, you know, you can put the Proc equation, you can massage it, and you can massage the massless vector equation into a form that looks like this. When you do this in asymptotically ADS or DS space time, okay? And this looks very similar to this guy, where the mass term is the cosmological constant. And sometimes the argument is, well, they must separate also for massive vectors in asymptotically flat because the equations are so similar, right? There's a couple of objections. The first is, well, if that was true, then you'd still have 2 degrees of freedom in the massive vector, which you don't, you have 3. And there's an intricate dependence of the cosmological constant on the background metric that is not present here. Okay. And also, of course, it's not this variable that separates typically, it's the Newman-Penrose variables. Okay. So, well, I don't think it's a given that the massive vector equation separates. Okay. So what we're going to do is study perturbations of slowly rotating black holes. What you do is basically expand the background in powers of rotation. You can do it for generic fields. You basically just expand at any order you want the variable depending on the tensorial character. If it's a scalar, you expand it in scalar harmonics. If it's a vector, in vector harmonics, and so on. The structure, which is quite generic, this is at first order, and it looks something like this. So this is a system of equations typically, okay? I'm showing you here what happens for the vector case. You get a system of equations, which I call the actual sector. If there is no rotation, we know they separate, okay? And we know that it separates in the actual and polar sector, depending on the transformation properties of these guys. When you have rotation at first order, you pick up terms such as this. This is some other set of equations, which depends on still only on the actual variables. But now you have coupling to the other sector, okay? Right? But these are only radial ODEs. You manage to separate the angular independence. You can see here the Zeeman splitting. The modes now are going to depend on the azimuthal number, m. You can see what Chandrasekhar calls the Laporte selection rule, which is basically coupling to L minus 1 and L plus 1 terms, and also what he was calling the propensity rule, which is the coupling to L plus 1 terms is favored over coupling to L minus 1. You can see this for L equal M modes. These guys are going to be 0, and you only have coupling to L plus 1.
So this works at linear order in spin, but if you were to go to second order, higher order, would this still continue to separate like this?
In fact, we can do this now for vector field at any order. Of course, you know, the number of equations you're going to be able to be solving is monstrous. But you can do it. So at second order, it gets a bit more messy. So you have a structure such as this. This is the first order term. Now you get couplings to L minus 2, L plus 2 terms between actual and polar variables. If you go to third order, you know, this stuff extends. But I mean, the important point is this is just, so to speak, a system of radial ordinary differential equations. Okay. So you can solve them. Let me show you the first order quantities for the massive vector. So you separate the way you usually do the separation of vectors. So you're basically taking always the Schwarzschild as your basis. This is the basis. You're decomposing vector spherical harmonics. At first order, you get a system of equations such as this. This guy is the operator in Schwarzschild. F is just 1 minus 2m over r. Okay? Well, at second order, it wouldn't fit here, but it's important that you don't stop at first order because we are interested in looking at superradiant modes. And superradiant modes are, well, you expect the instability to kick in at, the instability is going to kick in at omega, roughly this guy, right? So when you expand equations in powers of A, you're neglecting terms at first order, you're neglecting terms in principle, which could have this dependence. Okay, the equations are second order, so at most you're neglecting this guy. Okay, but this guy at the superradiant threshold is higher order. I hope this is clear, right? So if you neglect this guy and work only to first order, you're not going to have anything that's, well, that you could claim describes superradiance, or at least the instability point. Okay, so you always have to go higher order in A, at least second order.
All the L's couple, all of these use the couple.
Yeah,
you have to truncate this L and
Typically, yeah. I mean, typically you go to, I don't know, dozens of terms, and you check convergence.
With increasing.
Yeah. Okay. So you want to check the method and the results. You can do that first. For instance, I'm doing this at first order for massless vector perturbations. So I'm taking a massless vector field around Kerr. These guys don't have that problem. So even first order should be okay, because the modes are not super radiant. You know, they have a frequency which is larger than the rotation. And in fact, sort of like, so yeah, so this plot shows you the difference between the results obtained at first order in rotation and the exact results. Okay? And the difference is less than 1% till J, till rotation typically 0.6, 0.7 m. So you can go up to 70% of the Kerr bound and you still get 1% accurate results for massless fields. Okay? I think it's very nice. It's a very nice check on this stuff.
There's a curve there that goes way higher than 1% error.
Well, it goes way higher, but only after, oh yeah, actually, this guy after 0.2. Yes, you're right.
Okay.
This is the, okay, this is precisely the allopolemical one mode which goes to the super radiant limit. Very, very
good. You should stop at 0.2.
Yeah, this is just a check. We're not using this for anything. At second order, you get a much better agreement. So here I'm showing you the same thing, but now for the scalar field, this is quite easy because you have, you can do this at any order in seconds, okay? And this is how the agreement improves as you increase the order of your truncation and rotation. Okay? So at first order, actually at first order, you don't even have an ergo region in the spacetime. So it's quite amazing that you still get results which are reasonably close to the real thing, right? At second order, you get this region, right? And you can see that at fourth order, you basically describe, now this is a massive scalar, so it goes unstable after this point, okay? And you can even describe large portions of the instability region. Is there any question up to here, or is this being a bit confusing? No? Okay. So these are results for accurate at second order in J, okay? For massive vectors, I'm showing you here the inverse of the instability time scale as a function of rotation for different values of the Proca field mass. Okay? These are modes which I labeled, you can't really do that because they couple, but which I label as belonging to the axial sector and this as belonging to the polar sector, just because when A is zero, you can do this clean separation. There's something else I would like to mention, but I forgot what it is. Oh, so you find an infinite tower of modes. I'm only showing you the dominant that reduces to allopolemical one mode in Schwarzschild. But you pick, it's interesting because you're basically shifting the bases with respect to which you're decomposing the vector field, okay? And so you see when you're doing this and expand the spacetime around Schwarzschild, you're going to be picking up modes that in the Tsiolkovsky formalism you were calling L equal 2, L equal 3, L equal 4 modes. Again, it's a collapse Gordon, more or less style decomposition that George was telling about. Okay? But this is the dominant mode. The instability timescale in general is well described by this. It's nice that it agrees perfectly with a conjecture by Rosa and Dolan. They study the massive vectors around Schwarzschild. And it's also perfect that the exponent here is now not minus 9, but it's minus 7. Okay? It gives you a stronger instability timescale. So a smaller instability timescale in general. Okay. Okay. So if you plot, you can plot the stability or instability diagram as a function of the rotation parameter for several vector field mass. I'm plotting this in the electron volt. And I'm showing you the lines of several important instability, of several important timescales. Okay? This is the Hubble timescale. This is the Salpeter timescale, basically, assuming you have, it gives you the instability, the timescale for spinning up black holes if it's accreting at the end of the luminosity. It's just a timescale, 10 to the 7 years or so.
Do you have anything for stellar mass black holes? They would give you a much better.
That you would, but the problem is, so.
I mean, that would give you 6 orders of magnitude a better bound on the mass of the.
No.
So Peter's scale is independent of the
mass. No, but the stellar mass doesn't. You actually want to go the other way.
You want to go to shorter wavelengths? That's higher. Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah, you want to go to bigger black hole.
Yeah.
Sorry, just a basic question. What, I mean, if you had a proper field that equates these tiny masses.
These are tiny masses. So the.
Wouldn't they give you pitfalls?
Sorry? Wouldn't they give you what? So the current bound on the well, according to the data particle group, is 10 to the minus 18.
But then you have a cosmological bounds and a mass for the photon, and that's going to have a cosmological, I mean, maybe it's weaker, I don't know. I can't say everything.
So again, the current accepted bound is 10 to the minus 18.
And it comes from?
I have no idea. I have it somewhere here. I have no idea. I should know this. Well, believe me. So you can redo that plot in a different way, basically showing in the Rydberg plane the regions which are excluded, well, which are unstable in the JM plot. And I'm adding the values that I showed you in table in the second or third slide, okay, with the 8 supermassive black holes. Whose spin we know very well. Okay, and you see that this guy here, if you want to exclude, so if you have a massive vector field and it turns unstable, what's going to happen is that it's going to decrease the black hole spin until the super radiant stops. Okay, so the idea now is to constrain the mass of the field by saying, well, we do observe spins above a certain value for a black hole of a certain mass, and this means that the mass of the vector field must be below some value. Okay? And if you play this game with the Hubble timescale saying, well, the black hole had an entire universe time to spin down, then you already bound the mass of the vector field to 10 to the minus 21, which is 3 orders of magnitude better than current bounds. Okay.
But here we're assuming that these massive fields are sufficiently abundant and they are around this black hole to produce this effect.
But the massive field is everywhere.
Right.
Right, but then we have this process could clean out its region in some way, so it's active for a while and then.
There's an instability. Any tiny perturbation.
Right, you don't need, yeah. I mean, you could have a zero value everywhere, you just need a small spark.
So you get a better bound than what the Oxford group got for the massive.
Yes, just. Yeah.
For what? I mean, people have done the same type of bounds for massive scalar fields, the bounds on the massive axioms. And because there's a minus 7 instead of a minus 9, you get
a
bound.
Yeah.
Can you put a bound on the mass of the Higgs this way?
No. Come on, wavelength. What's the compton wavelength of the Higgs compared to the mass of to the size of a astrophysical black hole?
So, what's the time scale once the instability starts?
Compton
right?
Wavelength of the.
What's the time scale of the Higgs?
That's much shorter, and you can constrain something that's more than the time scale.
Because I mean, these things are not isolated in astrophysics. There's accretion disks, there are other stars, there's episodes, whatever.
and these things could spin up the black
hole. No, it does happen. I have a last line here which shows you, for instance, if you, instead of the Hubble time, you do a Saltpeter time scale by having accretion disks around the black hole. Of course, you see, this guy is no longer excluded in the Saltpeter time scale. But I think the Saltpeter time scale is, well, what I would say is the convenient thing to use. And still, you bound the mass now in the L line to within two orders of magnitude better. Of course, I'm going to try and address that later. It's a game, and astrophysics is dirty, so it's a dirty game. Okay, let me do a first summary.
Sorry, just one more quick question. But the current bounds on the proper mass aren't from this type of, they're completely different considerations.
Yeah, there's even laboratory bounds on the proper mass.
But they're all worse than this one.
I understand they're worse, but they're obviously not.
No, there are, there are. I mean, don't ask me the details of the experiments. There are bounds. The current accepted bound is 10 to the minus 18. Okay, I'm only taking 1 hour and a half more, okay? This is a summary of what I said up to now. It's four slides more. Super radius leads to interesting phenomena. We just looked at some of them very superficially. Several things you want to do going to, well, much higher order, basically trying to see if your fit, if your results are valid all the way up to nearly extreme black holes. Even though that's not very important, the spin of the black hole is not crucially important because the dependence of the instability on the mass goes like mu to the 7 or mu to the 9. So when you invert that to a time scale, you see you get square root to the power 7 or so of a number. So it's not strongly sensitive on the, you know, on the constant that describes instability. It's very mildly dependent on that. But anyway, to be interesting, we are also working on doing, using the same formalism, on doing the full perturbations of Kern-Newman. We have some results. They're not exciting. You know, you'd like to see some instability going on. We don't. It's all very boring. But in some sense, it's good.
What do you mean by full? Are you still using this expansion?
Yeah.
Okay, so if there is some non-perturbative effect,
you don't see
in the background, you delay.
Yeah.
But this is for four-dimensional Kern-Newman?
Four-dimensional Kern-Newman.
But you don't expect to find any instability there.
No, but it would be nice to find it. You don't. But I mean, it wasn't done, so anyway. Kerr,
it wasn't done, I agree, but...
But the extreme Kerr is marginally stable.
In fact, you could argue it's unstable.
Well, okay. Let me be conservative. It's marginally stable. So when you are charged, for me, it's not trivial to see, to understand where it goes to. Well, you know, things are always well understood until you show otherwise, so. Right? I think we can use the same formalism to study very generic theories or spacetimes. It would be very nice to understand the bar mode instability that Masaru was telling us about yesterday using this. If the bar mode appears at sufficiently small rotation, which, well, we don't know.
Well, I mean, based on Masaru's results, you would have to have pretty high spin to see the pinching up. So, it's potentially an answer for that.
But he wants to show instability.
I'm not so sure. There's a finite difference between 0 and 0.6, where it is. So.
Yeah, there's a finite. Okay.
No, but if you go to 4D and then study the dedicated stars, then those are the field over W worth 0.2.
But it's never continuously connected to the origin.
Maybe.
At least
it's speculative anyway, so.
I don't know.
And of course, you'd like to do time evolutions in the full curve spacetime. We are doing that and see if you find instability. Again, you know, you have to wait for long to see this stuff, and you wait. You have to be sure you're not looking at beating or some other stuff that could annoy your extrapolation. And finally, astrophysics is dirty, so could there be any coupling to matter that diffuses instability? I'm not going to discuss that. I'm going to discuss coupling to matter that leads to other interesting things. So four more slides, so bear with me, please. If you have matter coupling, for instance, to a massive scalar field, you can have interesting things which we are calling, or because other people call, floating orbits. This is still a super radiant phenomenon. Okay? Suppose, assume that this guy here, it's some planet, is orbiting around a black hole. It's coupled to a scalar field, for instance, in Brunswick theories. Okay? And you want to see how this guy evolves in time. Okay? The usual procedure is just do a balance equation to the energy. You know, the orbital energy of this guy, it's losing gravitational waves to infinity. Waves are going down the hole. You balance that and you see how much this guy has to lose. I mean, how much it goes inwards with time to balance energy loss. Okay? If you have super radiance, you can have stuff like the gravitational radiation flowing out to infinity is entirely compensated for by scalar or gravitational radiation coming out of the hole. Okay? And this gives rise to an orbit to a planet which is orbiting the black hole at a fixed, or well, in this adiabatic approximation, at a fixed location, basically extracting rotational energy from the hole, not in spiraling inwards. Okay?
Can you have this as an exact solution? Or, I mean, the black hole is changing.
Yeah.
The orbits are going to change.
Yeah.
It's hard to see how this could be balanced.
Well, that you can check.
And you can kind of...
Well, if the time scale for this change is very small...
Yeah. And, on long time scales, this can be almost...
You can do that. And if it works, if you have a massive scalar field, because you have this extra time scale, you excite resonances at frequencies which are of the order of the scalar field mass. So you can do this, well, depending on the scalar field mass, anywhere outside the black hole. Usually, it doesn't work if the field is massless. Just because massless fields have their resonant frequencies, concentrated near the light wing, let's say. Okay? So to excite those modes, you have to have some guy which is not on a stable circular orbit, for instance. Okay? I'm not going to talk about these massive fields. Let me just tell you about an interesting, well, I think it's interesting. I'll skip this stuff. This is basically details of the massive scalar field floating orbit. So this is typically the gravitational radiation lost to infinity. This depends on the coupling, of course. This is the scalar field energy outflux at the horizon, and at resonances, it can outgrow gravitational radiation lost, so you can have a floating orbit here. Okay? But what I think is interesting is trying to understand the absence of floating orbits when the field is massless. Okay? So trying to understand energy extraction from a different perspective, and if somebody has criticisms, I really appreciate that. And what we think is going on is exactly what goes on with the Earth-Moon system. If you look at the Earth-Moon system, there's a well-known theory, actually proposed by Darwin many, many years ago, to understand tidal forces and the effect of tidal forces on the moon, for instance. Okay? And it goes like this. So you basically assume for now there's no friction here. There's no friction in the system. The moon will raise basically tidal bulges on the Earth ocean, which are going to be aligned with the Earth-Moon direction, okay? If there's no friction. If there's friction, what happens is that there's going to be a tidal angle, which I call phi, okay, which describes the friction, and that makes the tidal bulges leave the moon just because the Earth rotates faster than the moon's orbital velocity. Okay, is this clear? So, of course, what this is going to do is slow down the Earth, and the net effect, you have to conserve orbital angle, you have to conserve angular momentum. The net effect of this stuff is that the moon is going to be pulled outwards. This is observed, these are the numbers, the moon is drifting away from us at a rate 4 centimeters per year, and the day is the period is increasing 0.002 seconds per century. And this is also the reason, this mechanism applied to the moon is also the reason why the moon is locked in synchronous rotation, okay? And you can work out the tidal bulge mass here to compute basically details of the moon's evolution, okay? This is a very simple calculation, and you will find that the orbital energy extracted goes something like this, okay? There's no black holes here, but you can imagine, what about if I extrapolate this number to black holes? If you do this game for black holes, then, so R here is the radius of the Earth, K is some tidal parameter, omega is the orbital velocity of the moon, R naught is the distance. So basically, you do this, you put R to the light to the Schwarzschild radius. We express the tidal angle phi in terms of some tidal time lag tau, which you, in the black hole case, promote to a light crossing time of the black hole, and you end up with something like this. You end up with an energy, orbital energy lost equal to this guy. Okay? Of course, if this was the entire story, then moons around black holes would spiral outwards always. But unfortunately, you know, when you have this stuff, unfortunately for me, there's also gravitational radiation loss, which you can estimate using the quadrupole formula. And unfortunately, the ratio between both of them goes like v to the 8, where v is the orbital velocity of the moon.
Isn't this similar to Eric's?
Yes. Yeah. In fact, this agrees with Eric's.
It's a set, right? I mean, it's. Well,
yes.
For Kerr, it's actually v receded to the fifth.
Yeah.
So it's a bit more favorable.
Sorry?
It's v receded to the fifth for Kerr.
For Kerr, it's a 2.5.
Yeah, this is very slow rotation approximation. Okay, so, you know, the ratio is never larger than one, it's always small, so you can't have tidal acceleration for black hole binaries. But if you do this for for a scalar field, massless, because I don't want to introduce any other scale, it's interesting because the game changes a little bit. It's not a quadrupole deformation now, it's a dipole kind of tide, if you want, okay? So the tide, basically now, you have a charged moon and a neutral Earth, if you wish, okay? So the tide is dipolar in nature. Okay, of course, the strength of the back reaction over the moon is going to be much larger. You can evaluate that stuff. And, well, I evaluate it for generic B. Okay? I should have the expression for 4D. In generic number of dimensions, if you work out the ratio of the energy flowing out of the horizon to the energy flowing out to infinity, it evaluates to this stuff for scalar waves. Okay? It's interesting because for d larger than 5, you always have tidal acceleration. Okay? Always. So energy lost by the event horizon is always larger than that going to infinity.
And then you have to worry about the issue that the orbits. Yeah,
yeah, I do. In fact, you also have, I mean, you can extend the analysis we did for the quadrupolar tides, and you have exactly the same thing happening for gravitational fields. So in dimensions higher than 5, this also tidal acceleration is very generic. Always happens.
This has nothing to do with the dipole effect you were talking about in previous slide, right? This is for uncharged black holes.
For uncharged black holes, but in some sense charged moons because they are coupled to the scalar field.
So you have a black hole with a much smaller Kerr-Newman black hole?
If you think about Brunswick. If you think about Brunswick theory, for instance, you can't couple the scalar to the black hole. Well, you know, there's a no-hair theorem. But if you put, you know, But if you put a neutron star, it is going to have a non-zero, a non-1/2 sensitivity, so it's coupling to the scalar field. That's the moon.
Oh, that's
And, by the way, this is the result of the undergrad student. This is a relativistic calculation in the point particle limit in the scalar case. We don't know how to do the gravitational case. The scalar case agrees even beyond our expectations with this guy.
But in the Brancisi case, we already know
this is the ratio.
That E dot is going to be, you know, at minus 1 pm or whatever. So really the thing to compare is not E dot to infinity, but it's E dot.
This is the ratio between E dot at the horizon and at infinity.
Right, so that's the E dot at the horizon. Is that larger than what you would expect from dipolar radiation in Brancisi?
No, no, in four dimensions, this all reduces to what we know, what we knew already.
But in higher dimensions?
Well, in higher dimensions, the power is going inverts.
What I'm saying is that in higher dimensions, and in four dimensions, the E dot to infinity is not going to be just the E dot that you get from gravitational waves. There's probably going to be an E dot produced by the scalar field itself.
Yeah, that's included here.
Dipolar.
Yeah, so this is turning off gravitational waves, only scalar waves. This turns on gravitational waves. It's included here. Okay.
Yes.
Well, okay. This is interesting. I don't know what's the relevance of this for higher dimensional black hole physics, because this was done within a circular orbit approximation, but circular orbits are unstable, and they are unstable on much shorter timescales, as already was saying. So I don't know. It's, I think, a funny result. Okay, so let me finish. This second half, tidal acceleration is very interesting. It may give rise to floating orbits if you have matter coupled to generically massive scalars or massive bosons. We just showed that even massive vectors also have supervalence. There's a lot to do, a lot to understand, and any suggestions are welcome. Thank you.
Can you comment on the point number four?
Well, all this calculation was done when the central mass is a black hole. You could think you could think of applying this to cases where the body is not a black hole. But it turns out if you look at the Newtonian analysis, you need dissipation, right? It's a crucial ingredient. Zeldovich recognized that already when he explained superradiance. We know that dissipation on the Earth-Moon system is caused by dissipation of the oceans on the Earth floor. And so you think, well, in general, it's not going to work if the body is not a black hole, or at least if you don't include some kind of dissipation there. However, I'm puzzled by the claim in this let's say puzzle, by the claims here, which say that they see a Blanford, well, they see an energy extraction type of mechanism working even when you have a neutron star or a star.
Well, you don't need that. So you can read our papers, but yeah, we claim the same, but you don't need a black hole.
But what, so, okay, that's but why I'm puzzled.
You have curvature.
You don't need the rotation.
No, you don't need the black hole. You don't need the main horizon as long as there is some relative motion between the external agent. In your case, would be the field, say, and the compact object in the middle. You're going to have attraction.
But can't you say that the magnetic field is doing the is giving you the friction that you need to
yeah,
do the attraction?
Yeah, so in that case. But that's so. What is the claim they have in that paper?
Well, the claim is they have. They have a fixed background, okay? It's a star, I guess, a perfect constant density star or something.
Oh, this is Milton Ruiz. Yeah, that's precisely what. So, but in that case, they took the star away. But you can even put the star back in. And as Eric was saying, the dissipating agents is the friction between the object in the middle and the magnetic field.
But there's no friction there. So I don't understand. There's no friction in this work.
There is, because what it's doing is, especially as it rotates in their case, it's pulling the field lines.
Right. Okay. This
you build tension on the lines, and that's energy.
Right. Yeah. But I have big problems with that, because you're basically you're just you are putting by hand the energy, you know, you're putting the energy by hand in your boundary conditions. And this is, so yeah, so basically you're saying this is not going to work here. If you put by hand, you can do whatever you want. If you put the energy, you know.
But what, you're not putting anything by hand?
You are, I think you are. I think you are doing it in the boundary conditions, at least in this work. But we can discuss this.
Yeah, let's discuss that.
Is this a calculation that you could phrase? It looks like it's the kind of calculation that you can do with a membrane paradigm.
Yes.
So it's done that way, or?
No, it's not in that case, because the membrane paradigm you put, you are relying on the black hole. In this case.
No, no, I mean in the case of the black hole.
In the case of the black hole, you could do with a membrane paradigm.
But that's what
the reason. Okay, thank you.
Let me just mention that in ADS, you can actually have some types of floating orbits that are, you know, you can really have two black holes that just go around each other and never merge. Stronger version.
And does it happen in any space time dimension? Actually,
what did you say? You can have two black holes. We have constructed this: two rotating black holes that are around each other, and they will never merge because the radiation that bounces off the ADS walls is just about enough to keep them rotating exactly the same angular momentum that they rotate.
Right.
They also rotate like this.
Do they get rotating?
Yes. Or else. You cannot match the killing generators of the horizon.
No,
it's
but it's
yeah.
Probably because of the contraction. Well, but that would be a very unstable situation.
It's unstable to super radiance because every time, that's why I cannot do this here. Every time you can build these guys, they need omega times L bigger than one, or else
right.
You don't have stable orbits even in higher dimensions.
Right.
That's why it does not depend on the number
okay.
of dimensions.
Okay.
But it's a side comment. This is the real world, much more interesting.
Would you
do
that?
There's a confusion about these floating orbits and just the energy balance argument. So if you just okay, let's just look at a regular binary, you've got a source and a sink, the potential energy and the gravitational waves, if total energy is conserved and you're losing one, there's no choice, it has to spiral in. But now you're adding an extra source and an extra sink with the scalar field and the rotation. So now it seems like it's a not non-unique problem. You can satisfy energy conservation in various different ways. So to get a floating orbit, in some sense, you're turning off the source from potential energy. And how is
no.
that? How you, because orbits aren't spiraling in anymore, so the potential energy remains constant.
Oh, you mean,
so
you mean
why,
how do we evolve a floating orbit?
Or how does, why does it float? Why does it stop? Why does the potential energy not behave? Or is, why is it not available as a source anymore at that point?
I think I don't understand. I mean, it is available. So we can see you can see the point where floating occurs. We don't know how to evolve floating.
But where does it come from? So at least my confusion is that I don't see it coming just from energy balance, because now you can't uniquely set it. You put two sources and two sinks, and you can adjust things.
Go back to the slide where you had the floating stuff.
You mean here?
Yeah.
Just say, okay, you've got gravitational waves that are being emitted, and now
you've got
scalar
them?
Energy. So you've got.
Let's say you start your.
Yeah, so here.
To the right.
Floating
right?
Occurs here, right?
Yeah. So you're coming from the red line, right? So you're dissipating, you're emitting gravitational waves, so you're in spiral, and you're moving in from the right to the left. Eventually, you reach, in this particular case, you know, 21 point something up, right?
Right.
And there, scalar field super radiance resonates. And
yeah.
So you turn on a negative amount of efflux. And that negative amount of efflux now, only at that point, balances out the amount of energy that you were previously radiating gravitational waves. So now you're totally down at zero. That's the argument that I think.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, I took over your answer.
No. Thanks.
No, but in the sense of, so I mean, why doesn't just continue this file? So, because you can then just, that resonance, now you're just extracting more rotational energy.
Right.
So you've got that extra source as well. Like, I don't see why that's going to stop the inspiral.
I think it's a necessary condition, not a sufficient condition. So, it's, you know, if you did have a floating orbit, you would need this condition. But it's not, I mean, like, you are not convinced that it's a sufficient condition to stop everything from.
Oh, yeah. I agree.
Well, unless you prefer to, you're saying that it's sitting at 21.5 to begin with.
that would be.
But even then, I think there are, you know, energy exchanges that can occur in
yeah,
many different
that,
places.
Yeah,
that's
yeah,
true.
Yeah.
But that acts, so this is for Amris, in principle. So, but that energy extraction, so that the spin down that's going to be produced on the supermassive black hole that's going to be changing the amount of E dot here and to the second order. So it's a different scale.
Yeah, we should talk about this.
You know, it's a next order in maceration.
Okay, so leading order.
So these statements are two leading order in maceration. That's why he had later in the conclusions what happens for comparable masses, because there, what Franz is saying is totally correct.
Yeah, show that to Nico.
So I think we can postpone the rest of the discussion.